I'm Dan Masterson, host of Strategy Talk, where we take a unique view of world events. We report news as history. With me today is the editor of StrategyPage.com and well-known military author, Jim Dunnigan. Associate editor and syndicated columnist, Austin Bay, also joins us.
Welcome, Austin and Jim. I thought we'd talk a little bit today about future stuff like we normally do about this time of year, what could be coming our way in 2016. Jim, what's the biggest thing that you see out there on the horizon that we're going to be facing or the world's going to be facing in 2016?
Well, something that a lot of people wish would go away is not, and that is the enduring presence and fear of Islamic terrorism. You can see in the United States, the presidential election campaign, both major parties are resisting the one upstart, Donald Trump, who's insisting that, you know, it's all about Muslims. It's always been the policy of the Western leaders that the it's not an Islamic problem, it's a terrorism problem. Only the centers in that area that are credible are those who study the historical record, may have largely been ignored. However, to their credit, Islamic scholars, both religious and, you know, scholars of the history of Islamic countries in general, are coming forward and pointing out that there is a problem. This is something that's been bubbling, you know, ever so quietly for the last 10 years in the Muslim countries. Very little of it has gotten translated into, you know, Western languages, English. But it's there, and it's become, gotten to the point where it's starting to bleed through us. And what they're basically saying is, this business with Islamic terrorism, which is now seen as a very real threat to the Islamic world. You've got prominent Islamic scholars, you know, respected Islamic, politicians, all coming out and saying ISIL, the new caliphate, is not just a danger to everyone. That's the only thing, for example, that the Sunni and the Shia world, namely Saudi Arabia and Iran, can agree on. But it's also a threat to Islam as a whole. Because as they point out, as Western scholars will point out, if anybody will listen to them, that, you know, this has been around for over 1,000 years. It's been tearing Islam, the Islamic world, apart for over 1,000 years. To give people an example, they can double check themselves. The thing that a lot of people bring up is that we owe the Islamic world so much in that they preserved a lot of ancient knowledge, invented some. But that all occurred 1,000 years ago, so it stopped. And nobody bothers to come out and ask, well, gee, why did it stop? You know, why has there been practically no advances from the Islamic world in modern science? The statistics are dismal in this respect. The only Nobel Prize is not counting the Peace Prize, which isn't anything to do with science. Has been won by a handful of Muslim, you know, scientists. But all of them had to move to the West because they could not do their work in the Islamic world. And, of course, this initially came out of a effort financed by Saudi Arabia, of all people, generally called in the West the Arab Reform Movement. And basically they're saying, well, no, you know, it's the Islamic fundamentalists who, whenever we start to, you know, adopt something that is modern, in other words, anything that date after the 8th century, fundamentalists say, no, that's haram, that is against Islam, it is forbidden, it must be destroyed, and that is usually followed by terrorism, mainly against other Muslims. You know, terrorism begins at home, as it were. We tend to lose sight of that. The only reason the West is paying attention to it now is because modern technology and all that oil money, a lot of which, you know, was donated not so much by the Saudi, the Muslim governments, but by wealthy individuals who personally, you know, believed in this this whole business of, modernity, any ideas coming from outside the Islamic world are un-Islamic. This basically gave Islamic terrorism a financial boost. And, of course, the World Wide Web and satellite news gave them a global reach. This made it a problem in the West as well, as everybody was made abundantly clear to on the 9/11. Happened in 2016 that this generalized recognition that Islam has problems, which are the problem, are going to become more public, and people are at least going to admit, yes, it exists. And I think it's basically, as it has always been, the Islamic world that's going to have to come up with a solution. And at least they are talking about it. It's only a matter of time, and hopefully in the next year, Western leaders will do that. And actually, we're already hearing progress in 2015. Angela Merkel, the head of Germany, she's getting a lot of heat now for letting in a million, Muslims and refugees from, violence generated by mainly Islamic terrorists and dictators. But she also is saying, along with several other Western European leaders, that multiculturalism does not work. If they want to come to Europe, they have to integrate. They have to basically assimilate, whatever you want to call it. They cannot basically establish enclaves of Islamic culture in the midst of, their host cultures. And that's something the Europeans resisted as a matter of doctrine for many years. In the United States, that's encountered a lot more resistance because that goes completely against the customs and the traditions of the United States, which basically enabled people from all over the world, including, Muslims from Muslim countries, to more fully integrate, which is why we have far fewer Islamic terrorists coming from Muslims in the United States than from any other, Western country. But that also, belies the point that there are some coming from the United States because, again, especially the young and the impressionable, I never thought I'd reach the age where I'd be making that comment in seriousness, subject to that, especially because of the internet and, the availability of old country, as it were, newscast, something which is totally new. Basically up until, the last few decades, when you migrated to the United States, you were basically cut off, from the home country, from the culture. I mean, you could buy newspapers, but, after a while, the kids didn't want to spend any money on that. It was something the parents did, and when the parents passed away, that was it. Well, that's no longer the case anymore, and one of the side effects of that is Islamic terrorists coming from everywhere, and hopefully, there'll be more of a solution to that in 2016.
Austin, what do you see the big challenge of 2016 being?
Well, I think Jim bringing up the problem of modernizing Islam, that is the big problem. Let me reflect on that just for a second, Dan. In 1992, I made a trip to I went to Eastern Europe part of that trip, but I was also in Istanbul, Turkish Thrace, briefly over in part of Anatolia, and I saw a pro Khomeiniist, pro-Iranian demonstration by young Turkish students, and they're Sunnis, in front of the entrance to Istanbul University. And the fellow I was with, who happened to be a professor at another university in the Istanbul area, a Turk, said, "Most of these kids out there are the sons and daughters of government workers or successful businessmen and women, and this is their way of rebelling against their parents." And he says, I look at it as dangerous. Now, you guys know I'm a big fan of Kemal Ataturk. I've done a biography of him. And I looked at that. I was also familiar with what was is now known as the Justice and Development Party, the AKP, Recep Tayyip Erdogan's party. It had another manifestation in the early 90s, predecessory Moderate Islamist Party. And I came to the conclusion that at some point the Moderate Islamists were going to test the modern secular orientation of Turkey that the Ataturk and the Republican People's Party had established in the early 1920s. And sure enough, that's happening. The reason I'm bringing this up, Dan, it's an aspect of what Jim's talking about. Jim was looking at it, and a very large global perspective. But there have been these modernizing movements within Muslim nations, culturally Muslim nations, that also meet the kind of resistance to acceptance of modernization, acceptance that other people look at the world differently than doctrinaire Muslim clerics do. Now, Jim's point about the internet being a tool of contact with the old country, well, it's also, and he alluded to this, a tool of proselytization by these kind of Islamist radicals. And the clerics who reject what they say, you know, the terms of modernity, and then some of the, there are moderate Islamists out there that said, well, we believe in democracy, and you've seen that in Tunisia with the Ennahda Party, which turned over power in a successful election. We haven't seen the Islamists in Turkey turn over power yet. Erdogan keeps winning elections by hook and by crook. But there are these currents, and as Jim has also written about, let me say this, about recognition, at least by the educated intellectuals and government class and some of the Arab Muslim countries, that our backwardness is not the fault of the colonialists, the imperialists, or the Christians, or the Hindus, or the Jews, or whoever. It's some of it's on us, if not most of it. That awareness has come about. It's been slow, and they run into the easy answer of the extremist, which just says we don't have the religion right. And of course, when they have to look at the videos from the Islamic State in the Levant, ISIL's videos, getting the religion right means cutting off the heads of everybody else. I don't think so. He's hit the point that this is the big struggle, and the reason I brought up 92, it was the looming struggle. It was the struggle then, if you want. Maybe it's been the struggle at least since the 1979 attack on the Grand Mosque in Mecca, which you look back saying there's the rise of a new form of militant Islamist terrorism. And Islamism again is a global ideology. The most virulent conflicts on the planet right now, and I'm even thinking of the ones that we see in the Philippines, Thailand, Indo-Pakistani war still has a element of this. Has an involvement of Islamist extremists, and it's that the ideology has got to be met over time. I think it will temper. I mean, there's only so many heads you can cut off before you get a counter reaction, and you see the counter reaction even in Egypt, which was an Arab Spring country. Return of the military and al-Sisi's government begrudgingly approved by a majority of the Egyptian people because it's preferable to the extremism of the Muslim Brotherhood. So I'm just following up with some thoughts on what Jim said, reinforcing his point. That's a big conflict, Dan, and it's not going to be resolved in 2016. In fact, it's a long struggle. We're looking at another, maybe it's another 100 years struggle to, with Islamist ideology.
Jim, what are some of the other things that we need to be taking a look at in 2016?
Well, there are still wars going on. In fact, there's something people should keep in mind is that terrorism-related deaths, primarily Islamic terrorism, in 2014 only accounted for about 20% of war deaths, which were close to 200,000 for that year. The death and destruction from wars has been declining since the end of the Cold War, although it popped up a little bit in the last few years, simply because, you know, there was more Islamic terrorism and more conventional wars, you know, popping up in various odd parts of the world. But the trend is down. In fact, the final data isn't in yet on 2015, but based upon numbers we have so far, up to December, through December, indicate that ISIL-related deaths are down. Boko Haram deaths, which was they were the most deadly Islamic terrorist group in Nigeria last year, even more, a little more than ISIL. They are down even more. And of course, terrorism-related deaths in Pakistan, which has long been a major area of Islamic terrorist violence. I guess, you know, it's always been there for decades. It's been active in Pakistan against, between various, Islamic sects, Sunni against Shia, Sunni against anybody who doesn't, conform to the most conservative, form of Islam. And there are many such sects in Pakistan, as well as the few percent of the population, which is non-Muslim. But that is way down because in mid-2014, the Pakistani army, which basically started actively backing Islamic terrorism in the late 1970s, finally got the message that the monster they had created was becoming a little bit too destructive. And they launched the major offensive into the last notorious, shall we say, sanctuary for Islamic terrorism. In North Waziristan, that's right on the Afghan border. And that, you know, has basically been a success, although the Pakistanis admit that it won't be completely over, they hope, until the end of 2016. But that has resulted in all those things have resulted in a major drop in terrorism, perhaps as much as half. In 2015, there were about 31,000 deaths in 2014. So that is a significant reduction. But more Muslims are waking up to the fact that this is mainly taking place at their expense in terms of lives and, you know, your wealth costs. And indeed, you can see this played out rather dramatically in Saudi Arabia after 2003 when Al-Qaeda canceled the unofficial truce it long had with the Saudi, you know, monarchy. That the Al-Qaeda could basically operate inside Saudi Arabia as long as they didn't, you know, kill anybody. Well, they started killing people inside Saudi Arabia because the Americans and British had invaded Iraq, which was seen as the greatest, you know, bad thing one could do. And they accused Saudi Arabia, incorrectly, of course, of actively backing that. The Saudis went out of their way to, you know, distance themselves from that operation. But a lot of it was staged, you know, in Saudi Arabia. Suddenly the popularity of Islamic terrorist groups in Saudi Arabia, which was always quite high when they took public opinion surveys and what have you, plummeted because several hundred Muslims were killed in a number of terrorism attacks, some of them against oil facilities. Now, none of these really succeeded, but that really scared the heck out of the Saudis because they basically have been living off that oil for two generations now. And, you know, all of a sudden, Islamic terrorism, which was much less popular. Now, there's still a lot of money coming out of Saudi Arabia and recruits. Most of the ISIL, the foreign recruits for ISIL, you know, they're not Syrian or Iraqi, come from Saudi Arabia. That has always been the case. You know, well, of course, we know that, the 15 out of 19 of the 9/11 terrorists were from Saudi Arabia. And that was not a fluke. That was basically, you know, part of the historical trend, which is still going going forward. But we're seeing a lot less of it because fewer Muslim countries are willing to tolerate it, even unofficially. There's still a lot of unofficial tolerance of Islamic terrorism. There are still some hot spots like Libya, which nobody wants to go in and clean up, not even the Arabs. The Arabs did go into Yemen mainly because that involved Iran. And that's still the big future war. I doubt if it's going to break out because the Iranians are hoping to, you know, be able to get the economic sanctions lifted in 2016. And then they can work on coercing Saudi Arabia to pump more oil and, you know, pump less oil, I should say, and get the world price of oil up because that is down like two-thirds since 2013. And that has hurt Iran and Russia big time. So we're going to see more activity on that front. Russia is hurting badly. They still have the support of most Russians, but that is wearing a bit thin. A lot of Russians are saying, hey, we keep supporting this guy Putin, who seems like a good guy and all that, but, you know, it keeps getting worse. And, of course, as we saw in 1991, eventually the Russians woke up. And what Putin has to worry about is the Russians will answer another wake-up call.
Austin, what are some of the other areas that you see happening?
Let me make one other comment again before we leave the Islamic need for Islamic reformation. Jim was talking about the recruits coming from Saudi Arabia. There was a Malaysian Muslim professor that I spoke to in 2002 in Singapore, and his line to me was welcome to our war. And what he meant by that was that more moderate versions of moderate strands, I should say, instead of version strands of Islam exist. But he had been concerned for a number of years of what he called Arab Islam showing up in Southeast Asia. And he said that what he meant by that was Wahhabism, the strain of Sunni Islam that is favored in Saudi Arabia. Favored, it's really effectively the state religion. And he said the money coming from charities, mostly with roots in Saudi Arabia, had funded kindergartens in Malaysia. He said there were some in Indonesia as well, and he says essentially they're, and this is post 9/11, obviously early 2002. He says essentially they're proselytizing 5-year-olds in kindergarten with this extreme Sunni interpretation, and he says we've been battling that, and now you're seeing that. I used a little bit of that, Dan, what I just related to you in an article I wrote for the Weekly Standard about the threats to the Straits of Malacca. And but anyway, that's a little insight on what Jim was talking about. Look, I said the most virulent, and I mean the ones that dangerous violence have the don't mean in largest numbers, but virulent have the extremist Islamist component to them. The really most dangerous situations, and we'll talk more about this, I'm sure, later today, is South China Sea, where you see the Chinese expansionism, and that the other component of that, too, is Japan versus China in the East China Sea over the Japanese islands off of the Chinese coast. North Korea still remains a huge problem for everyone, and we've talked about that. And Ukraine, Jim started talking a little bit about Putin's various gambits. Ukraine continues to boil. But sub-Saharan Africa, which we cover quite frequently on Strategy Page, I guess maybe the term for this is the third term, wars of the third term. Burundi is in near chaos right now. The African Union is thinking of putting a peacekeeping force in there. It's because the president decided to usurp the Constitution, get it changed. By the way, that constitution was built on the peace agreement that ended the last Burundian civil war, and get a third term, and now it's in turmoil. Joseph Kabila, the president of Democratic Republic of Congo, is doing the same thing in Congo to just get a third term, you know, essentially become a president for life. We've seen this in a couple of other sub-Saharan African countries. And we're poised again, at least in Congo, for a reignition of what was the Great Congo War. And, you know, I recall a couple of updates on a Congo trying to get a hand on how many people actually died in the last Great Congo War. And that, Dan, roughly you're looking from, say, 1996 to 2002, 2003. So it's there was a war that began without declarations and a war that just kind of petered out and still hasn't totally petered out. But the number of dead is in millions, not so many necessarily killed in combat or by attacks by armed forces on unarmed civilians, but deaths due to malnutrition, refugees, exposure, and the like. And the reason I say in the millions, because we'll sometimes see figures of 5 million, you'll see 2.5, 3 million, but there are definitely a lot of dead. And that was a big war. And it's set off again. And the Islamist component here is extremely small. It's the Allied Democratic Forces, which is a Ugandan rebel group that's now definitely an Islamist extremist group, really is a sliver of eastern Congo, and they're still trying to make themselves into a threat to Uganda. That's one that's largely tribal and political, and also there's the component in it of control of the vast mineral resources in Congo. And that could set off this year because the elections, presidential elections, are scheduled for November. I said 2016, I mean. They're scheduled for November. And you'll see the entire UN peacekeeping effort come for naught. And why? It's because Kabila thinks he's strong enough to become a president for life. That's something to watch, but it's not the only one in sub-Saharan Africa.
Jim, some other places that you're taking a look at?
I think in general, and this is nothing new, a lot of the wars that go on in Africa, which is actually most of them, tend to be ignored, partly because of a phenomenon which, again, doesn't get much play in the media, in that a lot of these warring parties, especially in civil wars and insurrections and what have you, are much less tolerant of the media. There was a time before the internet where the even the, among the worst, rebel groups and what have you, they would tolerate the presence of the media in order to get their message out or to try. And there is coercion. Occasionally, journalists would get killed and what have you. But they could get in there with reasonable assurance that they get out alive. That is no longer the case. And the main reason for that is the internet. In other words, these rebels and what have you, these various factions, don't need the traditional, the mass media to get their message out. They can do it on the internet and let the mass media pick up whatever they wish. Of course, most of it will be propaganda. From the bad guys. We saw that very close to home, so to speak, in Mexico, where suddenly there, and Austin reported a lot on this, where the gangs of the drug gangs, who were basically among the biggest killers in the world. I mean, it was an undeclared war, but the deaths were close to 100,000 over 10 years. They basically declared war on the media, and suddenly there was no news coming out of Mexico. And of course, any North American, any foreign media outlets that tried to send correspondence there they soon found out that they couldn't do it because basically their people, and not only were their stringers not willing to report anymore, the local, you know, correspondents, but if they sent one of their own people in there, they would just get killed, and their drug gangs didn't give a damn. So this business of getting access to what is actually going on in there has become much more difficult. Now, we get around it, and a lot of media organizations get around it. In fact, I lectured the CIA analyst once some years ago about this very subject, by basically using the internet as a news gathering organization. Now, as I pointed out, you know, to the CIA analyst, and as most of our readers know, that you have to be careful with this information because we get it. We have, you know, correspondence, shall we say, from all sides. So, you know, if I get someone, first I try to find out, well, who are you? And, you know, so if I get something from a Sunni, this was especially the case during the Iraq War. Are you a Sunni, a Shia, are you a Kurd? Again, you can use Google to basically find out, you know, what these guys have been saying in the news groups or what have you. You say, oh, okay, some are reliable with, you know, an asterisk. But it is a reasonable way to gather information in a war zone where the media cannot operate, you know, traditional reporters cannot operate, you know, freely anymore. And as far as I can tell, even major news organizations, they don't like to admit it, but they picked up on this, and so they'll say an unnamed source, blah, 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 and so they're using the same techniques we've been using for, you know, nearly 20 years now.
Dan, can I make a comment on that? First of all, what Jim's describing, it's a lot more complicated now than a long, long time ago. The contacts and some of the things when we get tips were from old war gamers who were fans of Jim's old games back in the simulations publication days, knowledgeable folks. Now there's a broader net out there, and you do have to be very careful of the sources. You learn something over time. Now, I'm going to mention two publications here in Texas that I think do a very good job of getting at what's going on in Mexico. Brownsville Herald and the El Paso Times. They're the newspapers in Brownsville, Texas, and El Paso. Brownsville is right across the river from Matamoros, and El Paso right across the river from Ciudad Juarez. And what I look at those publications, I'd say four or five times a month, just kind of graze them, see what's going on. And I think that they do what Jim was describing that we do in terms of being able to look and read between the lines in Mexican media. And also, I think there's some websites over there that are just run by locals. And they're dangerous locals. They have to keep their heads down, but they've got cell phone cameras. And this phenomenon that I'm describing along, it's much easier along the Texas-Mexico border because of how easy it is to transmit information, you know, make a cell phone call and the like. But this also occurs even in some of the more remote areas. There's a fairly good picture of what occurs even in eastern Congo and the Rwanda-Uganda-Congo border area, north and south Kivu provinces, because there's so many people living in these villages that have cell phones with cameras that maybe the first two or three days of reporting is not covered, or it's opaque, or it's wrong. But over a couple of weeks, 3 weeks, now, I know that doesn't fit the news cycle of a mainstream media publication. It does for strategy page. But you get a feel both from folks on the ground. And then there's also usually, I've noticed this, at least in the terms of looking at the operations in eastern Congo, MONUSCO, the UN peacekeeping, at least UN peacekeeping operation element, comes back and you'll get clarified reports on what their soldiers and police and military observers have seen in the area. And some of that looks to me like it's informed, not simply by talking to the civilians, but being able to pick up information off of the Internet. It is a good tool, but you have to be very, very careful how you use it. And then get back to the Mexico point is that I think that is why the Brownsville Herald and El Paso Times have been able to pick up some of the slack on reporting that it no longer goes on the Mexican side because of the threat I shouldn't say there are exceptions. There's a couple of publications based out of Mexico City. They're quite aggressive on covering the cartel violence. But they've managed to pick up the slack because of the threat to journalists in northern Mexico by the cartels. And one other comment on this. I've wondered if some of the journalists working for some of the Mexican publications haven't become certain kinds of quiet stringers for the American publications. So there is accurate information coming out, despite what the cartels have done.
Jim, I thought like to wrap up with just one last thing here, and that's the impact of the refugee crisis. We haven't really talked about that specifically. How is that going to continue to affect things throughout 2016?
Well, that is one thing that is pushing the European politicians to be more realistic about what is going on in the Islamic world. Now, anybody who basically opposes the refugees or opposes, just letting them come in as they wish and do whatever they want is called a racist or what have you. But the fact of the matter is that the people who are making the decisions do not have to live next to or among these refugees. And all you have to do is look at the crime statistics over the last, 10, 20 years. The Muslims not only don't assimilate, but they basically engage disproportionately in criminal activities. I'm talking about normal, the regular criminal activities, drug dealing, fraud, rape, murder, you name it. And this is something that has enormous popular opposition. And, for years, the establishment, shall we say, politicians would say, they're a bunch of ignorant racists, but they have the votes. And of course, a lot of these mainstream politicians, shall we say, the traditional politicians, are no longer able to keep the lid on this. And I think we're going to see the lid blow off in a lot more Western countries in 2016, simply because this pressure has been building for so long.
How do you see the disruption, Jim, in these places being expressed at the ballot box, in the streets, or?
Both. For a substantial change to occur, it's going to have to happen in the ballot box, and this is where the mainstream politicians who control the political system, they control the local politics, who gets nominated, who can run, et cetera, they don't absolutely control it like the religious leaders do in Iran, but they have enormous influence. And they're losing that influence. You had the Tea Party and other groups in the United States where you're getting the equivalent in France, and it's don't then and the mainstream politicians, the best and the brightest, as some Americans call the American version, are no longer able to contain it because basically the noxious side effects of the traditional leaders' decisions are basically forcing a lot of the voters, to the wall, financially, in terms of personal safety, et cetera, et cetera. And so there are going to have to be some major adjustments made. We've seen this happen before in Europe. I mean, for example, the Tories, took over when Britain's finally got tired of this, the post-World War II socialist experiment. And suddenly, the Tories came back in, the economy started improving, and a lot of Brits said, maybe just automatically voting Labour isn't such a great idea anymore. And that fundamentally changed, politics in Britain. You saw the same thing in Sweden, which was long touted as the poster child of, socialism in action. But what a lot of people never in the West at least, wanted to admit was one thing the Swedes did was they did not trash their market economy. They made sure they made it possible for entrepreneurs to start new businesses. They would tax the crap out of you. Once you got going and made money, and indeed it became, a slow news day. You could do a story about, which new Swedish millionaire entrepreneur had moved overseas for tax reasons. But the fundamental fact was that even the Swedes had to change, because this is a problem with democracy that is not new. It's thousands of years old. The ancient Greeks, documents have survived, debates about, how populist politicians, bankrupt, the city, get us involved in wars. All this sounds familiar, right? Well, this is several thousand years ago, and all because of this democracy. But as Churchill pointed out, democracy is a terrible form of government except for all the others. And so ultimately, democracy survived, but it's not a perfect form of government. It has some real problems, and we're seeing them played out right now in the United States and in Western Europe.
Well, let me make a comment on that before we close it, because look, we've seen this going on in reaction to primarily Muslim communities that refuse to assimilate in Western Europe. This kind of brings us back, I guess, to the beginning of today's program. You had Geert Wilders' party in Holland. With Pim Fortuyn, who was the gay sociology prof, who came back and said, "Excuse me, I really like living in a liberal democracy. You're going to have to adapt to us." And of course, he was assassinated. And now we're getting back into the really the roots of it in the 1990s. You've seen the French nationalists, now led by Marine Le Pen, they're slowly legitimizing, even though they've still got their anti-Semitic component that Marine's father had in spades. But we've seen it also in Austria, Hungary, now Poland. They are populist. Sometimes they're called far right. They're not necessarily far right in any classic sense, but they are a populist response to what they see as a failure by the current government or the government elites to take some of the actions, as Jim was saying, to protect what they see as national identity or protect their jobs, protect their country. And it's been building up for 25 years. I think, Jim, I do think you're right. I think we're going to see a lot more of this in 2016. And here in the United States, we've got our own version of it that's been really going on since for a decade. But certainly there are at least two or three politicians that can easily be recognized as populist, both on the left and the right here in the United States. So,
yeah. All right. Well, we'll leave it there. And next time, I guess what we'll be talking about is a little bit of a wrap-up of 2015. And so we'll see you next time.
Happy New Year.
Indeed. Happy New Year.